Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Rebecca Ferguson talks about her new movie, A House of Dynamite, as well as Mission Impossible and her complicated Irish roots. We review the week's new cinema releases, including Tron, Ares, strange horror called Good Boy that has a dog as its lead actor, plus a fantastic new Irish documentary called A Wanted Horror. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. I have to tell you, since I spoke to you last, I had a very strange weekend. I had to go to Dingle, the beautiful Dingle, in the south of Ireland, and I say south pointedly, for a news talk show. And I was there about 3 years ago, and I remember driving home thinking, I should fly the next time I come here to save a bit of time because it's beautiful, but it's a long way from where I live. So I booked a flight and I thought, this is great. And the flying time was 40 minutes to Farran Fore Airport. Then someone was going to pick me up and drive me to Dingle. Had it all worked out. I totted off to the airport with delight, thinking, by God, I'm a clever fellow. I'm going to skip all the traffic, all that queuing. And then there was a 5-hour delay. Nobody's fault. Storm Amy's. And I arrived in Dingle at 11:15 that night, having left home at 12:30. In a bid to save time, I was flying. And as I said at the time, man plans and God laughs. So anyway, that was my long weekend in Dingle. Anyway, I do hope you're well, and that is very much a first world problem. I do appreciate. In TV this week, we've a lot to get to, but in TV, I want to mention two things quickly, and they're not the most positive things in a sense, because I am a huge fan of Alan Partridge and indeed Steve Coogan. Everything Steve Coogan does, I'm fascinated by. And Alan Partridge is quite simply one of the greatest TV and film comedy creations of all time by Steve Coogan. And he's a new series out on BBC One on Friday nights, How Are You, Alan Partridge? And it's Partridge, having left his lucrative career doing radio commercials, he's now back in TV doing a documentary about mental health. How Are You, Alan Partridge? And he's traversing the length of England to talk about people's mental health, because there's a mental health crisis. And in a way, he's sending that up in a very Partridge-esque way. And so it's rich pickings. The thing is, as a massive fan, it was great to see him back and I smiled a lot. I didn't find it hilarious, which I usually do, Alan Partridge. And I'm not sure if he's changed or I've changed, but I wasn't doing the belly laughs I normally do for Alan Partridge, and I'm not sure why. So if you were watching it, please do let me know what you made of it, and if it was just me. Now, I also want to mention the new Victoria Beckham documentary that is now out on Netflix since Thursday of this week. And it's called Victoria Beckham. Brilliant title. It's 3 parts. And I guess it charts her evolution from, you know, starstruck child and teenager to becoming a Spice Girl and then one of the most famous wags, to use their term, when she was girlfriend and then wife of David Beckham, to becoming a successful fashion designer and businesswoman. This story is told against the backdrop of her preparing for her biggest show yet in the grounds of a Paris castle. And we have some people like Donatella Versace, Anna Wintour is in there talking about her. And here's the thing about this. You know, David Beckham had a documentary last year on Netflix, and I really found that very entertaining, even though it was managed and, you know, was kind of a commercial for him. It was very entertaining. Robbie Williams had a very entertaining documentary on Netflix last year as well, or the year before. And I'm not a huge fan of Robbie Williams, but you know, you have to bow at the ability of him to walk onto a stage at Nebworth and sing to nearly a quarter of a million people. And any documentary of this recent slew from Jennifer Lopez, Robbie Williams, David Beckham, George Michael, Ronnie O'Sullivan, the snooker player last year as well. What all these documentaries have in common is if you're going to spend 3 hours with someone, I think you want to investigate their fascinating life story and this prodigious talent that rose them above everybody else. And in David Beckham's case, it was football. In Robbie Williams' case, it was singing and being an utter showman. Jennifer Lopez, same as. The problem with this is, and I bear her no ill will, is that there isn't some kind of prodigious talent here at base that I can see. She was in a huge band called the Spice Girls, but by her own admission, she wasn't a great singer or dancer. So I just don't think there's enough here. She's pleasant company. It's managed to win an inch of its life. But as well, the Spice Girl era is rich for pickings, and that's not delved into that much. So I thought this was pretty boring stuff, I have to say. And in case you think, you know, I'm some middle-aged man and this isn't for me, like, I try and come to these things objectively. I watched it with my wife as well, and she was pretty bored as well. So I just think Victoria Beckham, hats off to her and all she's done and overcoming snobbery and fashion. But I don't think the story, or certainly the one they're telling in this three-parter, has enough in it to hold people's attention. So, sorry, but there you go. A decided thumbs down Victoria Beckham's new documentary. It's just called Victoria Beckham. Decidedly unentertaining, I'm sorry to say. However, this is something terrific to watch.
If we do not take steps to neutralize our enemies now, we will lose our window to do so.
If we get this wrong, none of us are going to be alive tomorrow.
There is no plan B.
We did everything right?
None of this makes sense. Making all these bombs and all these plans. The walls are just ready to blow.
Yes, now that is a teaser of sorts of a new film called A House of Dynamite. It's now in cinemas. It's not on Netflix until October 24th. And what we have is a single unattributed nuclear missile having been launched somewhere in the Pacific. And this race begins to determine who's responsible. Initially, White House experts kind of dismiss it as a limited threat, but it becomes clear that the bomb's on a direct trajectory for the city of Chicago and will hit its target in 19 minutes. And this frenetic period is kind of told in real time from multiple perspectives, including a missile base in Alaska with the American president, who's played by Idris Elba, in the White House Situation Room, where Rebecca Ferguson, great actress, who you're about to hear from, is in charge. And this is directed by Kathryn Bigelow, who gave us The Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. And she really weaves a kind of nerve-shredding piece of tension about the possibility, and a serious, serious possibility, of nuclear war. This is a terrific watch. I don't really want to say too much about where the film goes, but let's just say it's nerve-shredding. Kathryn Bigelow directed it, the first woman ever to win an Oscar for directing for The Hurt Locker all those years ago. She's back to her best in this. Rebecca Ferguson plays the woman who is the head of this Situation Room. Thinks initially nothing to worry about here. We see her with her son leaving the house, having some domesticity with a pleasant home life. He slips a dinosaur to her that becomes very important later on, which you'll hear about. And then suddenly she's in the Situation Room when all hell is breaking loose. Rebecca Ferguson is one of the most in-demand actresses, from being in Mission Impossible movies, though she wasn't in the last one, to Dune. She was in The Greatest Showman. She started life as a soap opera actress in Sweden in her teenage years. She was in that great show Silo, the TV show. A brilliant actress, highly in demand. So it was delightful to get to talk to her earlier in the week about A House of Dynamite and a bit more besides. Greetings from Dublin, Ireland. What part of the world are you in?
Where am I? London.
Excellent.
God, I could have said New York.
Tell me this. It's a great movie. It's very intense. all aspects of it. And there's some humanity in there as well, as you'd expect. But I wonder, from an acting point of view, was it very intense to film, or is it just another acting job?
I mean, saying another acting job feels so blasé.
Sure.
But the intensity was within the scenes, right? Because the way we filmed it, they had all the sets up and running. All the actors were in their rooms. They had cameras in all the rooms. On action, we all rolled. And you had like the Brady Bunch, we called it. So you saw everyone on the little screen. And we were acting. The takes were sometimes 20 minutes. And they were the actual whole scene.
Wow. That sounds intense.
And that is intense. But it's intense to a point that it becomes exciting and your heart's beating and you don't want to mess your lineup and you're trying to do an American accent and you're clocking where DEFCON is and the thing. And I like that part, but it's not weighty. It's not heavy. It's not hard to put it aside and you know, talk about other things on set.
Yeah. It's beautiful, the dinosaur that you stumble across in your way to work. I was once on a train a couple of years ago and a Batman fell out of my bag and I could see people looking at me thinking this guy's a man child, but it was actually from a child. So yeah. I really related to that scene. Was that your idea, did I read?
Yes, it came. Yeah, but it wasn't sort of an idea. It wasn't me going, hey, how about this? It was the way that Catherine directs. There's a scene, it's written. And to be honest, it was written as story time, but it didn't really work because the kid was quite bouncy and energetic. So we adapted.
As they can be.
As they can be. So Catherine was on her feet thinking, right, there's a train. Let's play with the train. And she was like, just wing it. Go for it. You know the dialogue. We know when he needs to come in. We'll just play with it. And I said to him, to the boy, why don't you give me the dinosaur? Just, what do you do? What do you think? And he did it so beautifully. And that was just that moment. And then I didn't think about it again until we did the scene when I was walking through and the change of the shoes. And I was like, what if I put the dinosaur on the shoe? And it had no meaning until at the end I put my hand in pocket and I hadn't placed it there. It was just there, one of the extra dinosaurs, and I picked it up. And Catherine was like, Barry, grab the dinosaur. And it became a journey. Mm. And someone once said to me, God, it's symbolism of extinction, isn't it? And I went... Yeah. I mean, I didn't think about that, mate. It was a bloody toy. It just had a journey. But it was quite funny.
That's funny. I was actually going to say to you, was it a symbol of extinction? So I'm awfully glad I didn't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I saw the Brachiosaurus.
I also read that you said, in a way, she's, maybe I've read this wrongly, but she's the realest character you've ever played. Is that the case?
What I said was, my son watched the film with me when I watched it the first time, and his response was, it's the first time I've seen my mum. Ah. And he said, I see the way that you are with Saga, our daughter, his little sister, the way that you were with me. And I thought, yeah, I probably haven't thought about it. We're given such little time. There's no character. Mm. I'm not really creating a character. I'm just making her as human and as embodied me as possible, the way that I would be with my sick child or my husband or some quirks, little jokes. So I think, yeah, in that way, I'm not a super agent or you know, Lady Jessica or power and almightier than thou.
Yeah.
She's just a mum.
Trying to get it done. Yeah. Albeit a very difficult job. You mentioned some of those other characters, and I know a lot of times people ask you about the big things like Mission Impossible and Dune and all that. But I wonder, just at a high level, because those movies are such involved productions that can send you all over the world to deserts, quite literally, and things like that. Do they take over your life, I wonder?
Dune, not. Mission, yes.
Okay.
Because they're all very different. You know, Mission asks of such, for me anyway, and I think Dune maybe did for Timothy. So we all had different relations to the characters and what we needed to do. I didn't really do any stunts, you know. I needed to convey a person who can carry a lot of information and be always 10 steps ahead of the game. Mm-hmm. And something more internal Whilst in Mission, it's all about training, stunts, be prepared, jump when they say jump, travel, go. It's adrenaline. So yeah, they're all quite different. And this one kind of had a lot of it in one.
Yeah, it certainly did. You know, I spoke to Angela Bassett a while ago. And even before that, this is not loads of name drops, but George Clooney as well. And both of those. Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
But who's next?
The reason why I bring it up, you're number three. So good.
Okay, thanks.
But they all did soap operas very early in their careers.
Yeah.
And they talked about the discipline of it, that it's like nothing else. You're given all these pages. You know, you talked about quick. It's so, so quick. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I wonder, because you were very young when you did soap operas in Sweden, or a soap opera in Sweden. Is that a discipline you'd recommend to other actors?
I never recommend anything, because I can't tell you to go and grab a role in a soap opera. You're kind of lucky with what you get, and you should grab as much as you can and play around with it. That's the hand I was dealt, and I went with it. But for me, that was school. You know, we did 2.5 episodes a day.
Wow.
We had two sets shooting at the same time, and we would get all the scenes for the week on a Friday. So you used the weekend to learn all of them. And whilst one was rehearsing, the other was shooting. If you were crying in this one, you would run to the other one whilst pouring Belladonna, clear eyes, into your eyes so that they were white and crisp. And then once you arrived, you shoot that one.
Wow.
So discipline.
Yeah.
Factory. Insanity. And that was my school. I mean, if I could have chosen something else, maybe I would have, but it's what I had. And it's been my path.
Absolutely. Obviously, you're talking to an Irish man, and I can't help notice that you have an English mother. And that's, of course, if the internet is to be believed, and one can never tell. But your mother's your grandmother's from Northern Ireland. And I wonder, that Northern Irish or Irishness, whatever you want to call it, can you say, it's a very hard, large question in 30 seconds or whatever, but what part of you does that occupy, do you think, in your emotional
You know what, my granny's 98.
Wow.
And I know she was, doesn't matter, but Catholic side of the Northern Ireland. She got out, she left when she was sort of 13. But it's also, my grandmother is a person who cares about everyone else but herself. And it's hard to get her story. Mm. And I've tried and I'm trying, but I'm also sensitive to the topics.
Sure.
But she was 13, you know, when she left Northern Ireland. And then she married a Scotsman, my grandfather.
A heady mix.
A heady mix. And they lived, and I was raised in the Lake District. You know, that's where they lived. So I feel like a part of everything, but not enough, because I don't really have the story. I was thinking about doing one of those. What are they called?
Who do you think you are?
Kind of the relative thingy.
Where they trace your... Yeah. You should.
Yeah, it'd be fun. But I also kind of want her to tell me the story. But her story goes a bit upside down now and all over the place. And everyone has their own version of our life.
And she's alive in 98.
Yeah. She lives in Edinburgh.
Well, hats off to her, and hats off to you. House of Dynamite is fantastic. And it's lovely to meet you, and continued success.
I love meeting you too. And I'll come visit in Ireland.
We look forward to it. Welcome anytime.
Thank you.
The great Rebecca Ferguson there, talking about her complicated Irish roots and her grandmother, and a lot more besides. And most importantly, her new film, A House of Dynamite, where she plays kind of the chief of staff in a White House situation room where a nuclear bomb may be on its way to America. A brilliant watch that I saw in the cinema, because it's in cinemas now, and it's well worth a watch. A House of Dynamite will be on Netflix on the 24th of October. It's worth seeing in the cinema before then if you're looking for something to see. So that was Rebecca Ferguson. Now, also in the cinema this week is Tron Ares, the third installment of Tron. So we'll be hearing about that after the break. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to some of the week's other new cinema releases. Chief among them is the return of Tron. Yes, the 1982 movie that is certainly a cult classic, possibly beloved, we'll find out, and a very interesting horror movie, well, you hear this, folks, where the chief protagonist is a dog. It's not as dumb as it sounds, because I have seen it. It's called Good Boy. Delighted to be joined by journalist, film buff, many monikers, who hasn't been on in a while, Niamh O'Reilly. Niamh, hello.
How are you?
Very well. So listen, Tron, it's Tron Ares.
Yes.
The third in the franchise. 1982 was the first Tron movie. 2007, was it?
2010,
Tron Legacy. This is the third one. Like, I don't want to be something, but the world wasn't dying for the next Tron,
No, and I think your feelings are not dissimilar to a lot of people. Mm. Like, I feel like the studio behind this has, since the beginning, to borrow a phrase from Mean Girls, you know, they're stop trying to make fetch happen. Like, yeah, they have wanted this to be a franchise for a long time. And I think in their minds, it's on a par with Star Wars or something like that, or it has the potential to be. And I just don't think the story, even in the 1982 version, the story wasn't there.
Did you like the 1982 version?
I did. Probably like you, we're similar kind of vintage. Yeah. Like, I would have come to it on the television as a young child. And it was state of the art at the time. Like, if you go back and look at it now, it's laughable. If I showed it to my kids, they'd be like, what is this? But at the time, it really was pushing the boundaries of CGI and what was possible.
Yeah.
I think it was always for a certain type of audience. It wasn't like a Star Wars catch-all.
No.
It wasn't the magic there or the mythology. It was always very effects-driven.
Yeah, and you could claim it was kind of prescient in terms of what it was doing in 1982. And we will get to Tron Ares, but just remind people, in the very first one, I can't even remember, someone was trapped in a video game.
So I went back and did a rewatch because I couldn't tell you the last time. They're all available on Disney Plus if you want to catch up. Did a rewatch. So it's Jeff Bridges in the original, and he is this computer genius and computer creator, and he does get pulled into the game, the grid, and he has to sort of fight for his survival inside the game along with other programs who play these games on what's called the grid. And he does eventually get sucked back out and rights the wrongs, and he takes over this company, Encom, which is mentioned in the third film.
Right. Yeah. And I remember there was a very well-beloved, I know it was beloved because I used to play video game Tron. So it did have a life, Tron, for
it
a
did,
long time.
For sure. Yeah. And like, there's a ride in Disney in Orlando, where they have
there?
The light.
I've been there, I don't remember that.
I think it's a relatively new ride, or it's been updated for the new film. Yeah.
God, I love Tron now that you're talking
about it. Go Tron, yeah.
Right, so we had Tron Legacy in 2010. Mixed reviews for that one. We won't spend much time on that. So let's move on to Tron Ares. Jared Leto is back, but Jeff Bridges isn't, for the most part.
No, he does make an appearance. Yeah. That's all I'll say about that. Now, it's interesting to note that this film is not a direct sequel to the 2010 film.
Okay.
It's not retconning it in any way, but it is not a direct sequel.
Explain to people what retconning
means. So it's not erasing it from history. It's still canon. Yes. And the people, the cast in that are mentioned in this third film with the intention that maybe their story will be explored in further films down the line.
Okay.
So, this just isn't their story in the third one.
Right.
But it's still the same universe. So there's a lovely exposition dump at the beginning for anybody who feels they don't know what's going on, but it isn't that complicated. Okay. So we have two sisters, one of them, Eve, played by Greta Lee, who have taken over Encom, which is the company that Jeff Bridges' character, Kevin Flynn,
all those years
in
ago.
The original. Yeah. So they're at the helm and they're very well-intentioned and they're sort of in an AI arms race with another company called Dillinger Systems. And that is run by a guy called Julian Dillinger, played by Evan Peters, and he's the grandson of the big baddie from the original film, Ed Dillinger. And he's cut from the same cloth. He's not a good guy. Evan Peters is having a blast, hamming it up as the baddie here, I have to say. And so these two companies locked in a battle for control of AI.
Okay, and where's Jared Leto in all this?
I'm getting to that.
Okay.
So far, both companies have gotten to the point where they can effectively 3D print with lasers anything from a computer game or a computer system. But the snag is they dissolve after 29 minutes. So what both companies are looking for is this thing called a permanence particle, which they both believe exists. They both believe Kevin Flynn created it all the way back in the 80s at some point, but hid it on a computer system. So if they can find this permanence particle, anything you can create in a game will be permanent in the real world. So in order to make sure that he wins this arms race, Julian Dillinger brings into the real world his super soldier, Ares, played by Jared Leto. And he is, you know, loyal and doesn't have emotions. He's AI. He's very sophisticated. He obviously looks like a human. And he brings him into the real world. But things start to get complicated when, I suppose, he starts to experience the real world for the first time. Emotions, maybe, feelings, rain falling on them.
And Jared Leto's character, the super soldier, is entirely AI.
Entirely AI. So he only existed before this inside the grid, so inside a computer system. Similar to what we would have seen in the first Tron, where there was sort of humanoid people who were computer systems.
And battling
each other.
Trope of, you know, we had it in Terminator where the robot becomes humanized, possibly in emotion and stuff like that. That's actually not the worst premise I've ever heard.
No, it isn't.
Permanence particle.
It's not bad. Like, it's not, like, the story isn't that
complicated.
And I think that's probably the biggest flaw with all of the Tron films. Like, they've always been very, I don't want to say style over substance, but they have been very effects driven, very visually exciting films. And I don't think the story has ever matched the visuals. You know, and not on sort of a complex or multi-layered way, or in a way that you care enough about any of these characters to make it something bigger than just a visual spectacle.
And is that the problem with this one as well?
I'll start with what I like, okay? Because I don't want to do this film
short
down.
List.
Yeah, no, I have to say, as I said, the visuals are off the scale in this. Like, you know, I think we've gotten to a point where your eye is tricked. You can no longer tell what's green screen and what isn't. And it's really, it is a visually impressive. It's for the big screen, for sure. And the soundtrack, it is a pumping soundtrack.
Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah. I've been playing it on repeat.
The
soundtrack is exceptional. And that coupled with the visuals, you know, you have the red lights and everything is very sleek. And in this film, the light gliders, which are those sort of motorbikes, they're really transferred to New York City. So all of that action is unfolding in city blocks.
Okay.
So it's really incredible, you know, and it's so good. It doesn't look like, oh, that's CGI.
Okay.
Or, you know, you're not sort of going, oh, well, that looks fake. From an immersive point of view, it's fantastic. And I loved all of that. But I just didn't feel, as I said, the story was there. And Greta Lee is great in this. She's a great actress.
Past lives.
Jared Leto has won an Oscar.
Yes.
You know, he's not a bad actor. But I just didn't feel there was a lot of chemistry between the two of them. And, you know, for a lot of the film, it's the two of them kind of going after this permanence particle and, you know, him sort of grappling with, as you alluded to, those Terminator-esque, you know, I know now why you cry, sort of, you know, figuring out the world and who he is, and maybe he's more than just an AI computer. And there's some little, you know, jokes and little moments in there, but I felt like they fell flat. I didn't really care enough about the two of them, which was disappointing. Because, as you know, the story wasn't bad.
Yeah.
It just didn't have it.
And is there a grand metaphor about AI versus reality in this? Are they making any points about that?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's very, like, it's very black and white here. So, like, Eve's character is, like, she literally wants world peace and to solve world hunger using AI. Like, the first thing she creates is an orange tree.
Right.
Whereas Julian Dillinger, the first thing he creates is a tank, you know?
Okay.
So he just wants to build military equipment, become a multi-billionaire, sort of take over the world. So they're very cookie cutter, good, bad. You know, I'm the goody, I'm the baddie.
And is there also some allusions to tech bros and things like that?
Not really.
Okay.
No. It's very sort of cookie cutter, you know, even the colours, you know, Greta sort of in white kind of colours and Julian is in these kind of dark, you know, sort of colours.
It's funny you say the story's just very black and white and yet it's this visually stunning piece, but it's clearly the story that's letting it down.
The story's letting it down, the script isn't great, but like, I feel like it's almost an unfair criticism because it's consistent with the Tron films. They were never about, and I'm not trying to do them
It's
down.
Reached its own low bar.
No, and this isn't a bad film by any stretch.
Okay.
Like, it's not a bad film. It's very entertaining. I think you could drill down into it and you could batter it on a number of levels in terms of storytelling and script. But I really think you have to look beyond that. That's never what these films were about. They are visual and it is entertaining and it tricks along at a really nice pace. Like I said, the soundtrack is unbelievable. So I enjoyed this, apart
despite
from
the flaws. Okay, so what would you say stars-wise for Tron Ares, which is in cinemas from this Friday?
I would say 3 stars.
Okay.
And I'd say it's don't wait for streaming. See this on the big screen. Okay. It really is intended for the biggest screen you can find. I think it's out in 3D.
Yeah.
I didn't see it in 3D. It might benefit from that. But it's, you know, for a weekend film, you can't go wrong.
Okay. Visually stunning.
Yeah.
Much like myself. So we better take a clip of Tron Ares.
Of the blockbuster franchise.
Well, I spoke to several of our board members, and needless to say, they are impressed. Julian.
Carry on.
Yes.
What are you doing?
Oh, just trying to change the world, Mother.
What's going on? You're hacking ENCOM?
It's just a peek over the garden wall. No one will notice.
What makes you think that ENCOM is any closer to finding it?
Because I know who else is looking for it, all right?
Who?
Eve Kim. She's following in her sister's footsteps. She's after the permanence code. I can feel it. So I'm going to find her. And when I do...
No, I don't like it. It's too risky, Julian.
That is a clip from Tron Ares, which, as I say, is in cinemas from this Friday. And Niamh O'Reilly, who's in studio with me, gave it 3 stars. Now we move to something very different. Good Boy, which I have to tell you, Niamh, I was in a cinema for a different movie that's coming out in a few weeks with the general public on Sunday night. And a trailer for this film came up, Good Boy. And people were going, they were kind of jumping in their seats slightly, which is interesting. But this is, in essence, a movie where the protagonist is a dog and not a CGI dog.
No, this is a real dog. His name is Indy, and his name is Indy in the film as well. And he's actually the director's dog. And he is the best boy. I mean, this should be called Best Boy, not Good Boy. Yeah. He's the loveliest dog ever.
But he's in a horror movie.
He's in a horror movie. And I know that that does sound a bit hokey.
Gimmicky, yeah.
And gimmicky. And I think probably when the director first came up with the idea, it was a gimmick, but he's done quite well with it. And there's sort of a trend for this, I think, in horror. We saw Presence last year.
Soderbergh, which told from the view of the ghost, wasn't
it? Yeah. Yeah, and then we had In a Violent Nature.
Oh, yes.
Which was also last year from the view of the serial killer. Yeah. Very nasty film. But I think we're kind of, you know, when it comes to horror, we're mixing it up in terms of the perspective. And I think it does give you something different as an audience, you know, because we're so used to seeing it play out in a formulaic way. So I thought this was an interesting take.
So tell us what exactly is going on. Indy is handmade or best bud to a guy who gets a house.
That's right. So Todd, and at the beginning of the film, we see Todd recovering from a mystery illness, a quite nasty mystery illness. And we see the dog by his side for most of this. He even visits him in hospital and stuff. Gets out of hospital, very happy. And he decides to take the decision to go and live in his late grandfather's house in the woods.
Where else?
Where else, exactly. And he decides that's where he's going to live. So he takes Indy and heads off. And it emerges very, very quickly after they arrive in the house that all is not what it seems. And there could be some sort of mysterious, even supernatural force lurking in the basement and up to no good. And it is no more than that. It's a haunted house story. And when you say it's told from the perspective of the dog, we see the dog. So it's not actually through his eyes. So the camera is sort of down at his level. So we see him reacting to like his owner's changing behavior, things like creaking floorboards, shadows, dust covers on top of old furniture, funny noises and smells coming from the basement. And really, like, not to overstate this, but like it is all on the dog's furry shoulders. And the performance this dog gives is unreal. And this is not a trained performing dog, quote unquote. He doesn't have a string of movies behind him. But the reason I think this works so well is because the director stood in for a lot of the interactions between himself and the dog. And he takes a very clever approach that he obscures the humans' the heads and faces. So they're either turned away from the camera or they're in shadow. So you're only really seeing the dog reacting. And that obviously helped for when he stood in and like had some reactions with the dog. And it's very natural and very believable. And like this worked a lot better than I thought it was going to work. And I think none of us like to see a dog in peril, whether you're a dog lover or not. And the director had to come out on social media and show Indy, you know, they're doing a lot of press at the moment and saying he's fine, he's totally grand, he wasn't harmed, you know, because people were genuinely worried. Their first question is, does the dog die? Does the dog get harmed? Was he okay? Did he get hurt in the process? So people, like, he's struck a nerve here with people. It's something that gets under your skin about a dog. And they have such a childlike innocent quality dogs, you know.
And the most faithful of
most faithful
companions.
And like Indy is faithful here, you know, he can see what's going on more than his human, than his owner can. Yeah. And he's trying every trick in the book to stop his human from going down this particular path. Yeah.
Jack Nicholson in The Shining or whatever.
Exactly, yeah.
So I saw this as well, but what did you think of this?
I loved it up to a point. I think, to use a dog analogy here, like when a dog starts chasing its tail, it just runs out of things to do. And I think it backed itself into a corner and it couldn't get out of it.
Yeah.
Like there's only so many times you can see Indy go into a room and sort of react to noises and smells and things like that before you sort of get a wee bit bored and it feels a little bit repetitive.
Yeah.
And this film is only an hour and 13 minutes.
Yeah, 75 minutes just about.
It's very short, and I sort of feel like it would have worked better as a short.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
This director, Ben Lienberg, has done a lot of shorts. I think this is his first feature film, and I just think it would have worked a lot better as an actual bona fide short. There just isn't enough there. He was very committed to this particular perspective and going with it and you know, keeping that going, but I think he needed to do something different just to hold your attention to the end.
The problem I had with it, the dog is brilliant, and it's you're googling, is this a real, like, he's so good, he's amazing, and you know, if there's an Oscar for dogs or whatever, he's the winner. But I just felt the story around it was, they found this brilliant concept, but then the horror around it was just too pedestrian, you know? And I also found that they didn't really pay any attention to the owner of the dog. Yes. Like, you just hear his voice, and it sounds like a guy doing, you know, English subtitles on Spanish soap operas. Did you order a pizza?
Yeah,
come here, India.
And I think a lot of that is because a lot of the time it's actually the director physically with the dog.
Mm.
And obviously the actor did the voiceover for it. So.
But the actor's voiceover isn't great at all.
No, I don't know why the director didn't just star in this himself.
Yeah.
He has this authentic connection with the dog. I don't know, maybe just for whatever reason he didn't. But like, it isn't scary. I mean, it's, you know, it's very old fashioned in its kind of, you know, shadows and creaky stairs. Mm. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with low budget, you know, horror.
No.
I think what's most scary, I think what most people find scary, is the fact that a dog will go to such lengths, you know, even when they're scared and they're frightened, and that beautiful bond a dog and a person can have, and how far, you know, they'll go for you.
Yeah.
And I think it's seeing a dog potentially scared and doing things that they might not really want to do for the love of an owner is the scary part. But as for it being, you know, a horror, it's
not The Exorcist.
No.
Tell me this, what would you say stars-wise for Good Boy?
I think because Indy was just the best boy ever, I'm going to say 3 stars.
Yeah, I'm going to go 3 stars as well, because you really have to admire the unusualness of it and the central performance of Indy the dog. That's right, you haven't tuned into April's Fool's Day show. Good Boy has a dog called Indy.
I think if you're ever doing one of your specials, there's legs in this for like the best dog.
Four legs, maybe.
When I was sitting down to think about it, there's so many great dog performances.
There's The Artist.
Oogie.
Yeah.
Great. And Hooch.
Yeah. And Hooch. Actually, maybe we could.
You know, I think there's
it's
something.
They're great films. Anyway, Shinsuke Leela. We'll get to that another day. 3 stars for Good Boy. Also, 3 stars. She could be being generous reading between the lines for Tron, Aries. Neve O'Reilly, thanks a million.
Thank you.
After the break, a fantastic new Irish documentary called A Want in Her, which won the Audience Award at this year's Dublin International Film Festival. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, opening in select cinemas this Friday is an extraordinary, an unusual film called A Want in Her. Artist and debut feature filmmaker Myrid Carton has been filming since she was a child. Her mother, Nuala, once a successful social worker, suffered, I guess what you call a mental breakdown after the sudden death of her own mother. In present day, or certainly in 2019, she seems to shuffle between rehab clinics, psychiatric hospitals, and occasionally the street. When Nuala goes missing somewhere in Ireland, Myrid returns from London to find her and picks up her camera again in response to this new crisis. Her search takes her into a feuding family, a contested house. Intimate, surprising, and sometimes very funny conversations with her mother and other family members, in particular her uncle Kevin, reveal the trials of loving someone who struggles with addiction and possibly bipolarity. So much of what I've said is captured on film, and we see this. Myrid has been using a camera ever since she was a child, which her mother gave her. And we see all sorts of things filmed from her own childhood. If you don't believe me about this being an extraordinary movie, it did win the Audience Award at the Dublin International Film Festival and has been receiving huge critical acclaim everywhere it's been shown. And I'm delighted to say Myra joins me now. Myra, hi, how are you?
I'm good, John. Thank you for that introduction.
Not at all. So listen, the thing I'm struck by, you know, Tolstoy, I think it was, says every family is tragic in its own unique way, something along those lines. And there's very few families that don't have trauma of some kind. And you have your fair share of it with your mother and indeed her past and her complicated family life. But did you have any reservations about sharing all of this and going as deep as you did?
Yes, and in some ways, no. I think, well, there was a constant battle going on for me in the making of it.
Mm.
I think self-censorship is a huge thing that we all have to deal with, but obviously mine was not as strong as most people's because most people don't go on to make a film with their family. And partly I would think it was because I was so driven by the sense that this is a universal story.
Mm.
As Tolstoy said, and you said so eloquently, every family is unique. There's a very particular aspect of hauntedness within my own family. But I don't believe that this is in any way a singular experience. I know so many people who have similar experiences. And I just felt that that story, the story of the family member, the supporting cast role, hadn't been told. So I was really driven to tell that story. And I wanted at the same time to be really focused on my own experience within that. And mm. that kept me right. Like there, I didn't go around trying to unpick the family dynamics or people's individual issues or even my mother's issues. I was very clear with the people in my life that it wasn't a biography about them. It wasn't mm. my mother's biography. It was a story about what do you do when one of your family members starts to unravel, who's responsible, how can you be there for them without losing yourself. Things that the daily dramas that people have to deal with in their own homes was what I wanted to show cinematically and to try to find some wisdom or insight or sense of relief in that. So that was my driving force and that kept me right. So often when I was making the film, I was thinking, is this going to be good or bad? And someone actually said to me, someone very wise, they said, you know, you can't really know that until the film's done. You can't preemptively say whether it's good or bad or right or wrong. You need to commit to the work and you make those choices in doing the work. And I found the boundaries, the creative boundaries in making the work, but also the film is really about boundaries as well in terms of responsibility and in terms of care. That's so much part of what this film is about.
You know, your mother features in this clearly, as does your uncle Kevin. And at times, they're very willing participants. At other times, you know, at one point, I think Kevin actually says to you, turn the camera off, Myrid. Was it a long process to get them on board?
My mother, less so in some ways, because my mother's been involved, well, maybe a longer process with her because she was in my art films when I went to art school in London in the like 2011, 12, 13 was when my family started to make their way into my work. And I say that because I don't think I did that consciously. It was such an organic process. And my mother, I think, realized that she could really show up for me in a way artistically. Mm. And she herself is an incredibly well-read, well-watched woman. Like she is more of an, I'd say, better film knowledge of the classic films than me. So she was very much I think the camera has become a tool in our relationship. Mm. I don't want it to continue to be a tool in our relationship moving forward, but I think that it definitely has been created space and allowed for me to ask questions and for her to be heard without being plunged into the dynamic that can cause us some trouble. But with my Uncle Kevin, it was different because I'd never turned the camera on him before. Even my Uncle Danny, who's in the film, he was in my art school stuff. But my Uncle Kevin and I he's been like a brother to me in some ways. Like we've been incredibly close my whole life. He partly would sometimes stay in our house when we were living in Derry. And I just knew, like, he's just a great character. I knew he would be amazing on camera as well. Like he's so funny. He's got great cultural references. But at the same time, it was difficult because, like, this really was a crisis for him, and in such a experiential way. Like, I wasn't the one that was living with her, you know, and I know that I had space away from it, but he was, I mean, if anybody is really at the crisis melting point in the film, it was him. He took her in, he was caring for her, he was doing the best he could, and it was an incredibly tough time. So I wanted to capture some of that in the film, but I also had to say, you know, I didn't capture, it was really the film's from my perspective and not about Kevin and her relationship. And once I was able to communicate to Kevin, like, look, this isn't about you. This isn't even about you and her. It's actually about me and her. And I didn't say to him, you're a foil to me in this film, but that's basically what he was in some ways. And he was able to take a step back and to recognize that it was an important film to be made about mothers and daughters. But I do think he shines in the film as somebody. Yeah.
Yeah. And he seems like a very Irish brother. And I mean that as a compliment. There are two heartbreaking moments in it from my perspective that I wanted to ask you about. Firstly, we see video or films you made when you were young. With a camera your mother gave you when you were, a young teenager, and you're acting out scenes of, you know, domestic disturbance almost, an angry mother giving out to a child. And these were, like, obviously this wasn't doctored or anything. This was made, whatever, 20, 15 years ago. You, what was going on when you made those movies as a teenager?
I mean, it's just, God only knows in some ways, because it was a revelation to me. And it was a revelation to me to watch them back. I would say, you know, the people I was acting in that piece with, they had similar experiences to me in some ways. And, so it was really revelatory for me to see that. And I think what I love about the childhood teenage tapes is that everything that's on under the surface as an adult is actually so bluntly put.
Yeah.
Children, like, women don't usually hit each other. It's not normal. Like, there's so much more nuance in a female disagreement. But to see this mother-daughter fight acted out with violence and shouting and high drama really showed what was going on more subtly when me and my mother have a disagreement, like the things that you can't bring to the surface. And I love the filmmaker Josephine Decker. I was working with her story editor, and partly what I love about her films is that she pushes energy from one scene into the other. It's almost like the unconscious of one scene driving the other. And that's what I wanted. There's like a hard cut from me and my mother talking to each other to this massive fight. And I wanted these slippages to be there, and also for them to show how children are, I read this book by Nancy Spurger Hughes, Saints, Scholars and Schizophrenics, talking about why there's so much schizophrenia in Ireland when we're so literate and poetic and often very intelligent people, but she talks about the schizophrenic being the symptom of the society. And I looked at some things that my Uncle Danny said and some things that these children say. It just felt like they were symptoms, and they were undeniable symptoms of something that was usually hidden. And that's why they're so powerful and potent in the film.
Yeah, yeah. And listen, I'm sure you're asked about this scene a lot, but there is a scene where we see your mother intoxicated on a bench. You know it's her in a kind of tragically funny moment, if you don't mind me saying, because she's wearing high heels, and you attest only she would be drunk on a street bench in high heels, which made me laugh amid the tragedy, I have to say. But, you know, you say to her later that you feel really guilty about that because you filmed her, and you apologize to her later for that. I mean, again, I asked you about reservations. That must have been a hard scene to put into the film.
It was a hard scene. That was the hardest scene to put into the film, because I suppose one of the things that comes up with the idea of reservation is reservation so often is what will people think? And especially in Ireland, that is a very strong, like, consensus-based society. That is such a strong impulse and drive in society here. Yeah. What will people think? What will the neighbours think? And I suppose that was one moment where I felt shame myself about what had happened. And there was even a conversation where some people said, I don't think you can put it in the film. It's kind of unforgivable, etc. Which was difficult for me to you know, to have those conversations professionally, but also obviously it's very personal. But I just felt like, no, my Kevin and my mother and my Uncle Danny had gifted me with themselves in all the best and worst of them at times, and it was my job here to do the same. Like, I'm not a saint. I have, you know, my own issues. They're not alcohol, thank God. But I just wanted to document the experience of being a daughter, but also I'm a filmmaker, and sometimes the camera can be used for good and sometimes it can be used for bad, or even more nuanced, it can be used for connection or disconnection. I decided to put it in, but the insightful thing to do was not to start off with that shot, because it's too voyeuristic. You have to get to know me. You have to get to know my mother and fall in love with her to feel the weight of that scene from the inside as opposed to from the outside.
Yeah. It's funny. You talk about your mother being articulate, learned, you know, very knowledgeable of classic movies. And I had the experience that as she got talking, she seemed like great company, you know, and it's a crude way of putting it, but nearly once she sobered up and we saw her in the cold light of day. This is nothing to do with the film, really, other than I'm so curious, particularly after the film was over, and you don't have to answer this, but how is your mum today at the time of speaking?
Yeah, she's doing really well. She's, you know, it's the longest she's been well, both, with both of her afflictions, the addiction and the bipolar, in my adult life. And she is really enjoying being a new grandmother. And, you know, she's been involved with the reception of the film. She came to the premiere in Amsterdam for IDFA. And I think she owns her own complexity and her own issues very well, and also her own recovery very well. And I think people do want to know about her because she is a great person to be around. She's great fun. She's funny. She's good crack. I think my producer Tag and her really hit it off. I'm really delighted that she's doing so well in her life, and she's got a level of independence as well now that is new, and she has a really good relationship with my father. So things are going well for her.
You just threw in she's a grandmother there. So who had the baby?
Me. I'm an only child, so it was me.
Well, yeah, I just didn't want to assume. Well, congratulations. How long ago was that?
6 months.
Wow. And you're promoting a film, talking to people like me, while minding a six-month-old baby. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Yes, it's put things in perspective, you know. It's also hilarious to me that you can make a baby inside your body, and you know, 1/6 of the time it takes to make a film. It's ridiculous.
Wow, there's a lot going on in there. Well, that might be a perfect place to finish with new life and indeed a new movie. We're not sure which is the harder to make. I've been talking to Myra Carton, whose debut feature, A Wanton Her, is in select cinemas. It is an extraordinary film. As I mentioned, don't just believe me. It won the Audience Award at this year's International Film Festival and is getting rave reviews. I saw 4 stars in The Guardian this morning, the paper of record when it comes to movies. Myra, lovely to talk to you, and I hope the film travels far and wide for you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, John.
I saw her. I knew straight away it was Mommy because of the heels.
She's been with me 8 days now.
She'd been sleeping rough.
I just started losing grip on reality.
What should I do about Mommy? I used to live in here.
Is that all you?
Yeah.
No, Mary, stop.
Mary, stop filming, please.
A clip there from A Want in Her. And before that, you heard me talking to its writer and director, Myra Carton. A beguiling and fascinating watch, which is in select cinemas from this Friday, the 10th of October. That is it for this week. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage about anything you've been watching on the big or small screen, email screentime@newstalk.com. I'll remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead, and I will talk to you all next week.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.